Hi there, this is Steve, but this isn't the beginning of the show. Before we begin, I invite you to check out my free masterclass called The Surprising Path to Excellence. If you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or leader with financial responsibility in your company, you'll definitely not want to miss this one. I'll cover how a winning strategy combined with operational excellence drives higher cash flow and firm value. You can watch it for free at cultivar.com. I'll also link it in the show notes below. I hope you enjoy it. You're listening to the Strategic Financial Leadership Podcast, a podcast for entrepreneurs, business leaders, and professionals who want to elevate their game and reach new levels of abundance and success. I'm Steve Cofran, the founder of Cultivar, and I've spent my entire career growing and turning around companies, and together we'll explore the latest happenings in the world of strategy and finance. Let's do this. Before we begin, just remember that this podcast is for educational purposes and the information shared herein should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. Check out our terms and conditions in the show notes to learn more. Now onto the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Strategic Financial Leadership. Today I'm excited for this one because I like the space of alternative assets and I have a seasoned financial expert, Ben Frazier, on the show. He is the Chief Investing Officer of Aspen Funds. And he's actually in my hometown area in the mountains of Breckenridge today. So Ben, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you and I have a ton of questions for you.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for having me on, man. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we're going to be talking about leveraging alternative assets, just like the ultra wealthy do, which I think is going to be a really interesting topic, especially as they're becoming more popular and they're becoming more or a bigger part of people's portfolios. So before we jump in, I'm sure a lot of people on the podcast listening to it right now, they know what alternative investments are, but let's just set the stage and provide a little bit of context for those who may not be as familiar with that terminology. So what are alternative investments? What are these asset classes and how are they different from just like stocks and bonds?
Yeah. Great question. And I think alternative assets and investments is kind of a catch-all term. So it can mean a lot of different things, different people, but generally it's anything that's not stocks, bonds, mutual funds, right? Which are kind of the mainstream type assets. But more specifically, it generally implies, private investments. So those that are not on publicly traded exchanges. So, direct ownership of real estate, investing in oil and gas, which is something we've done, private equity, which you have a background in, venture capital, hedge funds. These are kind of some of the bigger categories within kind of the private alternative investment world.
Yeah. And when I was the CFO of the fintech company, as we were talking about before the show, this was an area that we were particularly interested in, especially with like changing regulation. And I think a lot of regulators and people at the top, they realize that, the alternative asset space provides a lot more upside for people compared to those who are just buying stocks and bonds. And particularly because, you go and you buy Apple today, right? And you can, there's still some upside, TBD on like their new goggles and everything else, or their virtual reality headset, whatever it is. But there's still some upside in some of these companies, but you're also coming in later in the game. Versus like the alternative asset space, it allows people to get in and either have direct ownership in like real estate, or you're getting into a company in early stages and the upside could be 20 to 30 times versus 20 to 30%. So what is your thought on that, and why are alternative assets becoming more popular in today's lexicon of business?
Yeah, I think there's a whole kind of confluence of things happening that are, shining the spotlight on alternative investments. I was actually having a conversation yesterday with a guy who, was a serial entrepreneur, had started, scaled, and sold four businesses. And so he was kind of selling to private equity and had been very successful, had, four good exits. And so he was selling his businesses and he was in tech. And so, generally selling a higher multiple, but he was selling at say a 4 to 7x multiple on EBITDA, which is great. If you're making $1 million of cash flow a year, you can sell, the business at maybe $4 to $7 million dollars. But then as he, got his liquidity and he had his big chunk of cash and he's now investing it into the S&P and he's looking at price to earnings ratios, was trading that time at say 18, PE. Yeah. Which is more than double what he sold his business for. And so that's commonly referred to as the liquidity premium, right? So publicly traded investments generally trade at a premium price because of the liquidity that you have. But the argument is that liquidity worth, you know, 100% higher price, you know, double the price of what you could sell in the private markets? And then I think if you look and dig deeper into liquidity and some of the research that we've, you know, shown on our podcast and have dug into, especially looking at the ultra wealthy's portfolios, liquidity actually cuts both ways, right? It's good to have liquidity, and it's important to make sure you can cover, you know, expenses and emergencies. But ultimately, as humans, we are emotional and a lot of times can succumb to the herd mentality and, you know, buy when things are high and sell when things are low. Right. And that's the opposite of, you know, the successful pattern. So liquidity actually can be a helpful tool when you're trying to go through, you know, make it through more turbulent economic times. And so, you know, kind of not get too deep in the weeds here, but, you know, generally the private markets sell at a discount because of that lack of liquidity, but it also provides, you know, one, true diversification from the public markets, which over the past decade have become more and more correlated, you know, stocks, sure, bonds, mutual funds, they're all kind of trading in a very tight correlation. And you also can get generally higher returns, you know, in the private markets because of some of the dislocations of and inefficiencies in the market.
No, and that's interesting. And so you mentioned something, the podcast that you guys have, Investing Like a Billionaire, and that's what you talk about. So how do billionaires invest, and how does that compare and contrast to just the normal Joe who's out there, you know, buying stocks and bonds and mutual funds and putting money in their 401k?
Yeah, well, I think we already gave away the punchline, but the kind of research we've done is, you know, as we've studied these ultra wealthy, these billionaires, family offices, endowments, you know, high net worth, ultra high net worth individuals, and looking at the portfolio allocation, generally there's a very large allocation to private alternatives. And, you know, Yale Endowment was actually a pioneer in this model. I think it was about 30 years ago when they really started investing outside the public markets and investing into private equity. It was kind of their first foray into it. And, you know, they were kind of one of the first ones to do it, but they had outperformed pretty much every other endowment. And a large part of that was because of this allocation to private equity, to real estate. And that's become more common over the past couple, probably about a decade or so, as the access to these types of investments is becoming more and more available. And generally what we've seen, there's a great report that's published on a quarterly basis by a group called Tiger 21 Global. It's basically a group of ultra wealthy individuals. You have to have at least, I think, 20 million of investable assets to join the group. And then they do surveys and they publish kind of the group's, you know, average portfolio allocation on a quarterly basis. And you'll see that generally over 50% of the portfolio is in private equity, real estate, you know, private equity, buying businesses, venture capital. And those generally make up between 50 to 60% of their investments. You can contrast that with kind of the average retail investor that's just investing in stocks, bonds, a 60-40 portfolio. You know, maybe they have some REITs in there, maybe they own a rental or an Airbnb, but it's a very small portion of their overall portfolio. And so what we found is kind of the biggest difference is the alternative investments. And that's what we've really focused on in our podcast, is educating about this whole landscape that is really rapidly growing.
So, and let's talk about just accessibility to this, because let's say somebody's listening to this and like, yeah, Ben, you know, that totally makes sense. You know, I want to carve out a sliver of my portfolio. I want to go into alternative assets. How do they actually do that? You know, it's not like you call Blackstone and you say, hey, I mean, Blackstone's a publicly traded company, but it's not like you call Blackstone or KKR or these other private equity companies and you're saying, hey, I want in. A lot of the funds are closed, right? Where you can't even get in. And then with real estate, I mean, you could get together with some of your buddies and buy some commercial property and you get at a discount right now, TBD on that. But yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like how are alternative investments becoming more accessible, and how do people access them?
Yeah, excellent question. So in 2012, there was a regulation called the Jobs Act that kind of fundamentally changed this whole alternative investment landscape. And so prior to 2012, the only available way that these investments could be marketed was through what's called a 506B offering. And that precluded them from sharing it with anybody that they did not have what's called a pre-existing and a substantive relationship with. And so generally, these deals kind of traded within these ultra high net worth circles, and it never got outside of that because of the regulations. Well, in 2012, they actually expanded that regulation. It's called Regulation D. It's an exemption from publicly registering. And they now allowed public marketing of these investments as long as the investors are accredited. And so if you're accredited, you can basically invest in any of these different types of deals. And, you know, rules of accreditation basically mean you have at least $1 million net worth, or you have income exceeding 200,000 as a single income earner, or 300,000 as a joint. So if you kind of hit one of those two metrics, you're accredited. You don't have to take a test or anything. You just are. And that gives you kind of this access to these deals. Now, the question is, where do you find them, right? I mean, a lot of operators and sponsors, myself included, are running ads on Facebook, right? And trying to get people to aware of what we're doing. And, you know, there's just the standard marketing stuff you see, but generally I always tell people, start with your networks, right? Start with finding the people that you trust and you already know are maybe doing some of this, and talk with them. What are they doing? And what I've been seeing really over the past couple of years is we've been doing our podcast. We've been bringing on people that are actually running these pretty cool digital communities that are just trying to just help each other improve and talk about deals and, hey, what's working for you? What's not working for you? And these are virtual, so they're sometimes have 1,000+ members in them. And Tiger 21 is a great example, but it's pretty big barrier to get into that. But there's lots of them. And just expanding your network to expand your deal flow is really, really important. And what I always tell people, I mean, the biggest knock on alternatives, you know, aside from the illiquidity, which is something you have to consider when you're, you know, coming from a portfolio allocation standpoint, is also the opaqueness, right? There's not as much transparency. These aren't publicly registered investments. And so who you invest with is of the utmost importance. It's the number one factor that you need to be evaluating, right, when you're doing due diligence. And so, you know, we talk a lot about due diligence, you know, when we're, you know, going on the podcast and things you should be looking for. But ultimately, you know, start small, start slow, start with your network. And, you know, I think you can kind of build over time, right? Because what I tell people all the time, like a guy recently was working with us and he had a liquidity bank, sold his business. He had a big chunk of cash. He's like, hey, how do I live off this, you know, big chunk of cash? And I said, hey, just, I know it's going to be hard because you have that kind of cash burn a hole in your pocket, but go as slow as you can trying to deploy the capital, because the deals you do at first, you probably won't do, you know, down the road. Maybe there'll be some you know, good ones that you do, but you just learn so much as you start doing it. So just dipping the toe in, just kind of getting your feet wet, starting to you know, make a few investments, make small investments. And, you know, sometimes the minimums are a little bit higher than, you know, if you're going, you know, buying, you know, some shares of Apple or something, but a lot of times you can negotiate the minimums, and a lot of times you can partner up with other investors and, you know, get lower minimums. So there's this, a whole landscape is really shifting, you know, and trying to make it more accessible to kind of the retail high net worth individual. So yeah, the BlackRocks, the KKRs, it's pretty difficult to get in their funds unless you are going in through an advisor and they have an allocation carved out. But there's a lot of other great things out there for people kind of getting started.
No, and I think that makes sense. So let's get into the nitty gritty here. Let's say somebody is listening to this, like, okay, cool. I have $1 million in investable assets right now that I want to put to work. And sure, I want to allocate it over time. That makes sense. But I have $1 million that I want to carve out and put into, you know, alternative investments. How would they, like, how do you actually do that though? Like, so you join a Facebook group, or you hear things on a podcast, or, you know, you're talking to somebody else and they say, yeah, I know this buddy who knows a buddy, or here's a friend, or here's this or that. And of course you do your due diligence, but like, is there like a listing of alternative investments? Like how does somebody actually listen to this right now and then take the next step?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's like crowdfunding platforms like Fundrise, there's Equity Multiple, there's CrowdStreet. There's a lot of, you know, what I would say VC backed, heavy marketing forward companies that are doing more crowdfunding. And so they're a platform technology that is trying to sync up credit investors with operators. Okay. And so there's instantly a really good place you can go and, you know, get access to deal flow. So as you kind of start getting into it, you start, you know, doing the Google, you know, searches, talking with some friends, listening to podcasts. The number one thing is education. Just do as much reading, you know, listening to podcasts, whatever your preferred method of, you know, consumption is, and just educate yourself, because deal flow actually probably won't be the problem. If you kind of start getting going on this, because like I said, there's with these regulation changes, there's been a flood of just new investment opportunities. You can invest in, you know, wine now. You can invest in, you know, raw land in third world countries. I mean, there's sure. a million different things you can invest in. But the bigger issue is, what should I invest in and who should I invest with? And so that's where understanding what some of the kind of basic tenets of due diligence are, and, you know, not succumbing to, you know, good marketing tactics and other things. And ultimately there's risk that, you know, of Ponzi schemes and other things out there, and that's always going to be a risk, but that's not necessarily, you know, only in private market opportunities as well. So I think there's not like a big listing platform out there that here's all the different places you can invest, because there's thousands and thousands of operators to invest with. But I think it's really looking at the ones that are educating first, have good reputation, have a good track record, been in the business a long time, and are, you know, doing the things right for their investors.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, I know so many people out there that they're into making a quick buck or get rich quick schemes. Right? And there's so much garbage out there too on YouTube and whatnot, where people are giving like sketchy advice, or they're saying, oh yeah, you know, I took $1,000, made into $100,000 in like 3 months. And here's, you know, just, there's all that stuff. And you know, there's this guy I know, and he put a bunch of money into this platform to invest in like penny stocks, and seriously put like $20,000 into it. And it went down to like seven, you know? And I just think there's a lot of cautionary tales out there, but I think that to your point about like getting to know like what's behind the investment, you know, I always talk about free cash flow. So it's essentially when you're buying a business or any type of asset, like whatever it is, think of it as a machine, like a dispensing machine that's dispensing cash. So you put cash into the machine to turn it on, and then hopefully you put in 10 and you get 20 or 30 or 50 out of the machine one day. But I think so many people, they forget about just the basics of free cash flow. That's why, like, you know, I'm constantly harping on, it's free cash flow. It's not revenue. It's not, you know, profit, EBITDA. It's free cash flow. You could have EBITDA, but then account for working capital and capital expenditures, and you have no free cash flow, right? So ultimately it's cash that you care about. So if you understand that and you understand, okay, what's the cash flow stream here of this investment that I'm getting into, that I think that's one good way to protect yourself and protect your investment. But what are your thoughts on that, Ben?
100%. Yeah. It's hard to beat cash flow as a good barometer for, you know, the attractiveness of an investment. I think as humans, like I was saying before, we're drawn to the lottery type, you know, returns. And yeah. I put a little bit of money in and I get $1 million out, and it's the shortcuts, right? But in investing in life, there are no shortcuts. So if it sounds too good to be true, it absolutely is too good to be true, right?
Yeah.
And if someone's saying something that sounds too good to be true, challenge it, push on it, ask the questions. A lot of times what I find is a lot of people don't feel like they have the ability to do due diligence on an investment, right? And there's a lot of technical things, and sure, if you want to read an income statement or a balance sheet, that's one thing, but you could ask pretty simple, straightforward, basic questions that are just kind of common sense, and you'd be surprised at some of the answers you may get sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to there is no shortcuts. I think it's, you have to think about this as a portfolio approach, right? I think another error that I see a lot of investors make is they kind of get into these circles where deals are just flowing. They got a lot of deal flow and they get the email and, you know, it's, this deal sounds good. This deal sounds good. And they just kind of invest haphazardly into random deals. And then you take a step back a couple of years from now and there is no, you know, consolidated approach to the investment strategy. And all of a sudden they have 50% allocation into, you know, Dallas multifamily. They didn't even realize it. And hey, that's may not be a great place right now, especially if they're heavy value add or other things. Like there's things you got to think about as not just the deals themselves and getting the right operators involved with them, but also the portfolio side of it. Because if you can go with a disciplined approach, it's going to help you from making some of those errors along the way and continue to have, you know, good diversification, you know, better uncorrelation to the markets, better returns, et cetera.
Okay. So what's a realistic return on capital that somebody should expect when it comes to alternative assets? Like I know the S&P 500, if you go back to like 1965, the returns are something like 9.6 or whatever it is, call it 10%. Returns on the S&P just with stocks and equities. But when it comes to alternative investments, what should somebody just anticipate, or like what's the level set expectation for returns?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I always use the term risk adjusted returns. So, you know, that's generally called the Sharpe ratio, you know, in public equities. But it's a concept that I think is really important to think about when you're investing in alternative assets, because what people tend and gravitate towards the most are the highest return, you know, projections, right? Oh, I'm going to make a 25% IRR and I'm just going to invest in all 25% deals. Well, you have to account for the risk you're taking to achieve the projected returns. And so what I would say is it's really a strata of risk relative to the reward. And on kind of a conservative, what I would say more income focused kind of investment, anywhere from 6 to 10% cash on cash is very achievable. So we have a debt fund. It invests in single family mortgages all across the US. We pay out 9% monthly. Fund's been going on 10 years and it just keeps chugging along. It's pretty boring, but it's consistent and it's a great income generator because it's current cash. If talking about free cash flow, it's a lot of free cash flow.
Yeah.
Then I would say you have kind of your other segment, which is kind of one step up, which is maybe a core plus or a value add strategy. So these are kind of terms that we use in real estate a lot, but they kind of apply to multiple asset classes. And the idea is you're buying something that is mismanaged, maybe like in real estate, an older property, but it's in a good area and comparable, you know, rentals are going for much higher than you're currently renting at. You can put some money in, you can increase revenue, increase NOI, and hopefully increase valuation. So that's a very common strategy. And those, you know, probably range anywhere from 12 to 18%, you know, returns. Yeah. You're going to have less of that is going to be on cash on cash and more of that's going to be on common exit. So you always got to look at your IRR, how much of that is weighted towards an exit. And then you have your opportunistic or development type opportunities. Those are generally going to be, you know, 20 plus IRR, but you're taking a lot more risk because you're either repositioning an asset, you're taking distressed assets, or you're building something and you're taking on additional risk like construction risk, market saturation, et cetera, et cetera. So there's kind of a whole strata, right? But I think a nice, well-rounded blended portfolio, you can probably get into the mid-teens pretty comfortably without taking too much risk.
Okay, that makes sense. So obviously you're an expert in this space. If somebody came to you and they pitched you, they're like, Ben, you know, here's this great deal. Check this out. Here's this prospectus. Like, you should definitely invest. Do you have like one or two questions where you're like, I would definitely ask this, and this is going to give me like a go, no go decision to the next step. And if so, what are those questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of use this metaphor. It's kind of stupid, but it's helpful to kind of break down the components of when evaluating the deal. So you know, it's like for horse racing. I'm not a horse racer. I don't know why I came up with this, but it makes sense to me. So I'm going with it. But there's kind of three parts to every investment, right? So you have your track, you have the racetrack, and that is basically what's the asset type and or the geography of the asset. Do I believe in the story of the Sun Belt markets continuing to have net demographic trends to the positive, right? Or do I think there's more opportunity elsewhere? So you have to look at what's the big picture, what are the macro things going on behind the investment itself? Because you could be investing in a great asset, but if it's in a bad market or it's in, you know, a market that has, you know, negative migration, you're fighting against, you know, headwinds that you're not going to be able to overcome. So you have to understand that first. And then the next part is the horse, right? So that's the actual, I'd say the asset, the business or the piece of real estate that you're investing in. And you want to understand what's the strategy there. What is the free cash flow, if any? What's the kind of business plan and what's the timeframes to achieve that business plan? And then kind of the last piece is the jockey, right? And I think this is the one that people focus the least on because, you know, it's the deal itself or the market that kind of gets all the hype. But look at the jockey, who's running the deal? How many deals have they done? How long have they been in operation? Have they done this type of strategy before? Is this something that is, you know, they have management expertise in? You know, you want to look for an alignment, all three of those. And then the other piece of that is a deal that might be right for you might not be right for me, right? Maybe I'm, you know, 65 years old, I'm retired, and my goal is income generation and wealth preservation. Well, I'm probably not going to go into an opportunistic or development deal, you know, in an area that maybe is up and coming, right? That's just probably too much risk. But so I think you have to do that personal evaluation. But then I'm going the long way around to your question. I think some of the like really key questions, just to get a really quick gut check of if a deal is good or not. You know, first off is alignment of interests. When I read a PPM or a private placement memorandum, right, this is basically the equivalent of a prospectus on the stock. You know, these are basically details out everything in the business plan, the management team, the asset, the market, the fees, the waterfalls. I go straight. The only two sections I focus on are the waterfall section and the fee section. Yeah. I want to go see how much they're taking, and I want to see how they get paid. And do I feel like it's an alignment of interest? And do I feel like the incentives for them to outperform are in alignment with me making good returns? And then the next question I always ask is, how much are the principals putting into the deal, right? Because there's no better way to show an alignment of interest or confidence in a deal than for the people operating it to put money right alongside your money. And so I think that's, you know, just at a very high level, just a real quick gut check before you even get too far into a deal is look at those things.
No, I love that. I think that's great. That's very smart. So let's keep going and let's narrow in to real estate specifically as an alternative investment. So there's been a, you know, an explosion in this area, I would say, about podcasts, about investing in real estate and flipping fixes and all this stuff out there, right? There's people that do it legitimately, but there's also like, yeah, my dentist, you know, he's like flipping houses now and doing this. And you're like, what? Your dentist is? And so I think there's a lot of quality type of things out there, and then there's not. So maybe some advice on that, but that's not my real question here, man. It's kind of a long question. You'll notice my questions are like really long. They have like 10 parts, and it's like, what? But here's the thing that I'm interested in. Okay, so somebody's sitting here and they're listening. They're like, okay, let's say they have $100,000 that they can put into real estate. They're like, I want to get more into real estate. So they could go out there and they could put 20% down or whatever and try to buy an investment property. And they could do that, right? They can take it and put it into something like you said, like Fundrise or some crowdsourcing platform and invest there. You can invest in a REIT, right? A real estate investment trust. And you could invest in a publicly traded REIT like right now and say, hey, I want to invest in shopping malls or retail or, you know, data centers, whatever. There's REITs for everything. They could put their money in there, or there's other approaches out there with real estate. How does somebody like navigate, okay, where should I go? You know, which asset class should I go into? And, you know, and maybe you could address the REIT thing too, because, you know, you could put your money into a REIT, but like, is all the upside already gone? You're like, you're putting it into something and now you're just investing in low returns? And what are your thoughts on just all that? There's a lot of questions in there, but
yeah, that was about 10 questions to see if I can remember all of them.
Yeah.
First on the REITs, I think that's a really important thing to talk about, because the question is, well, I can't invest in real estate, or people say I already am investing in real estate through REITs. And I would say, yes, you have exposure to real estate or, you know, segments of the real estate market, but you are paying a liquidity premium, like we talked about before, that you may not realize. So one kind of quick way to kind of see and, you know, show that premium is the price to book ratio, right? So for stocks or tech companies, price to earnings ratio, the PE ratio is a standard of what's the price that I'm paying for a dollar of earnings.
Yeah.
Well, similarly, a price to book ratio is what's the price I'm paying relative to the book value of the assets of the real estate, right? So when you're investing into a syndication or a real estate private fund, you're going to be pretty close to 1-to-1, right? $100,000 investment is going to get you pretty close to $100,000 of real estate. And you probably have a little bit of fees in there. So it's a little bit less, but not that far. We went and looked just, you know, earlier this year. I got to update the analysis, but I'm sure it's probably pretty similar as the whole market's still gone up here today. That the price to book on average for like some of the top REITs range anywhere from 3-7x.
Okay.
Right. So let's use 5x as just a simple number. If you invest $100,000 into a REIT, $20,000 of that is actually invested into real estate. Right. And so again, I don't think REITs are necessarily bad. I think it can be a portion of the portfolio, but I would argue that the premium you're paying to have a liquidity is too expensive. And when you then compare the direct benefits, tax benefits of ownership of real estate, you know, whether you're buying a rental yourself or you're buying, investing in a syndication or a fund, the tax benefits they're the best there is. You can't beat the tax benefits in real estate, especially if you're actively investing in real estate like me, where I can take all my, you know, tax losses from my investments and take them against my active income. And it's pretty incredible that the tax code allows for that.
Yeah.
But for someone that's not active, you can still take, you know, all these deductions through depreciation, through these things called cost segregation studies, where you can accelerate and have additional depreciation pushed through in the early years. You can write off a lot of passive income that you're generating from your other investments and can continue to kind of defer. There's a lot of cool strategies around that. But I think those are kind of the two big things, you know, relative from direct ownership to REITs. So yeah. I think the other kind of question you have to ask yourself is, okay, I want to get into real estate. I know it's a good place to be, but do I want to actively own real estate or do I want to be passive investor in real estate? I have a lot of real estate assets that I've invested in. I don't actively own any of them. And I've chosen to do that because I don't want to be an operator. I don't want to have to worry about, you know, tenants that aren't paying, you know, the maintenance issues and the calls at midnight when the toilet's leaking, all those kind of things. So that's just a personal preference of mine. I know several of my friends that they've made a lot of money by being active in real estate. So I think you have to kind of make that determination. But there's this kind of this big learning curve where the first few deals you do, even as an active investor, you're probably not going to make a whole lot of money because you don't know what you don't know when you get started. And so you kind of have to commit to that to the long term if you're going to do that. And arguably, you can make just as good or better returns investing passively in more like middle market deals with bigger operators that have economies of scale, full teams and systems built out for these types of deals that they've been doing for a long time, right? So there's kind of this trade-off there. But, you know, I think if you only have $100,000 to invest, it's going to be hard to get a good diversification into, you know, private equity real estate, because a lot of minimums are $100,000 or $50,000. Some of the crowdfunding platforms are a lot lower. And then you can also invest in like private equity real estate funds. So we operate real estate funds. So it's basically one investment and you kind of get diversified into multiple asset classes, multiple properties. So you can get some more diversification with a smaller dollar amount. Yeah. So those options are out there as well.
So how
another
do you
question,
sure,
but yeah.
So let me ask you this. Now, how do you make sure you don't get jacked in the process? Because, you know, you put your money with somebody and they're like, okay, yeah, so our fund, we invest in real estate. And I get there's there's a lot of legwork, there's research, there's operations, operation costs. And I mean, there's all this stuff. I get it, right? So I get the fees. So I'm not knocking it, but you can also get in deals where it's like, okay, so I take a fee on, you know, sourcing the deal and then finding the property. Then we close on the property. And then I take this and I take this upside. And I mean, next thing you know, you're like, holy cow, like who's getting rich here? Like the owner of the fund or, you know, me as an investor. And so how does somebody make sure they don't get like stabbed to death with fees and, you know, they're putting all their money at risk, but they're walking away with a fraction of the returns.
100%. I mean, you got to watch out for those things. Before I get into like what standard fees should be, I think people, it's not both sides, because in REITs, there's some of the heaviest fee vehicles out there.
Completely.
And there's the upfront loads can be 10% or more. So you have $100,000 immediately, the investable cash is like $90,000, right?
Yeah.
Because they have to pay all the broker dealers and all the kind of marketing fees and other things. And I would say you have a lot less of that in the syndications, because part of the idea is like me as an operator, I can go and market directly to investors and I'm not paying any intermediary to help make that connection, right? I'm paying Facebook or YouTube or whatever. And there's actually less fees. Now we are taking fees when we're doing deals. And you know, that what I would say is when you start kind of getting into this space and you're starting to look at different deals, like I said, focus on the waterfall. And the waterfall is simply, what's the order and preference of payment between the investors, the limited partners, and the general partners, the operators? And you know, there's kind of some industry standards that you'll begin to notice over time. And then the fees are the same thing. So generally you have like an acquisition fee to make an acquisition of a property. Sometimes you have a disposition fee when the property sells. A lot of times you have an asset management fee that's kind of as a fee that, you know, for managing the asset along the way. And there's some other things inside, you know, that are additional or extra you can see, but generally there's kind of some industry standards that if they're way outside of those, that's a pretty big red flag, right? Because what can happen, and what I think happened really in the last 10 years, as you mentioned earlier, what I would call a pretty big syndication boom, right? You know, as we had more access to these, there's a lot of, I don't even call them bad actors, but I think people that, to your point, was a dentist and thought he could, you know, go live a passive real estate lifestyle on the beach, raising money for real estate,
right?
You know, got himself over his skis, and you know, that happened a lot. I mean, there's an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal of a huge syndication that just blew up in Houston, and you know, it's sad. I mean, because these guys were, I mean, it's really one guy. He was a joke, and the hard part is differentiating between bad actors and negligence and ignorance, right? Because sure. I think there's a lot less bad actors out there than you may think. Like there's most people, I don't think, go into a deal thinking they're going to start a Ponzi scheme, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Evaluate Ponzi schemes. Most of them happen, you know, by just small degrees, and eventually they kind of get in trouble and then they try and cover it up, and they cover it up with something else and something else. And it kind of compounds into something that all of a sudden they're stuck, right? They have no other option than to continue going that route. I don't think most operators go into a deal trying to start a Ponzi scheme or a scam. Now there are people that do that, but that's a very small percentage. The bigger issue is watching the deals unfold over time, right? Yeah. And so that's where you can do a lot of your due diligence up front. And I think that's important, but then you really have to maintain, like read the quarterly report, see how things are going, ask for the financial statements. To your point earlier, I send out financial statements in every single deal of mine every quarter. I don't ever get a question on any of my financial statements from any investor. And it's probably because they're not looking at them. But, you know, in all the deals I'm in, I'm looking at the financial statements. I want to see how are they close to achieving their business plan? What does the cash flow look like? You know, what is the budget in, you know, relative to actual performance and all those kind of things. So I think it's, you know, is a good question. There's a whole lot of angles to take it, but the fees themselves, it's really getting a gut sense of what's kind of industry standard and what things could be red flags or yellow flags, both in the fees and the waterfalls. And I would say largely a lot of the big people that I'm not going to say any names in the podcast, but they're probably all over your Instagram, Facebook feed, you know, the celebrity capital raisers. I reuse them, their PPMs, and maybe the assets are okay and the strategies are pretty good, but they're feeing you to death, and they're making a lot of money on closing the deals, not necessarily operating the deals. So that's the other big red flag. Right? Are they making their money as an operator just doing more deals, or are they making their money really on the back end if the deal performs well and if the performance goes well over time, right? So you can have an asset management fee that's actually tied to the income being generated from a property. So the higher that income grows, the more they make, right? So there's just always look at the alignment of interest, like what's the incentive alignment? And that's always one thing I'm looking at is where's the misalignment of incentives that doesn't benefit me as an investor?
Yeah, I agree. And I think we're entering an interesting era where, I mean, there's a ton of cash out there that's chasing fewer assets, right? And so it's compressing returns and you get, you know, all different types of, you know, wacky incentives, and they're not being aligned. And to your point, sure, if I run a fund and I'm sitting on, you know, $100 million and I know I'm not earning anything until I put that capital to work, then yeah, I'll just go out there and buy real estate. Like who cares? Who gives a crap? Like I'm going to earn a fee just by acquiring the asset. And that can be a very dangerous thing if you're not aware of that, because what's the incentive behind the GP to, you know, protect the LPs, really?
Absolutely.
Because yeah. It's like heads I win, tails you lose. You know, I raise all this money, I'm the GP, you're the LP. Okay, I'm getting all these fees. Oh, it didn't work out. You know, sorry, I know I said our returns are going to be 15%. It's actually negative. So you just don't get your money back. But I walk away and I have my yacht and my giant house and you're screwed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, definitely something you got to be aware of. And I think, you know, that is a challenge, especially for bigger allocators to where they've raised these huge funds. I mean, BlackRock included. And I think BlackRock's a great manager, but they're going to have a challenge, right? They just raised one of their biggest real estate funds ever. And there's like no transactions happening in real estate in this past 6 months. We'll see what happens over the next 6 months, but it's a double-edged sword, right? Raising a lot of money is great until you can't deploy it into good deals. And so they're going to have to figure out, do we return capital back to investors just because we can't deploy it? Or do we have to change our underwriting standards, right? And that's something you got to watch out for.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to switch gears here for a minute and talk about something a little bit different. It's related, but I think the big thing is there's a lot of pundits out there and experts, you know, like the Dave Ramseys and so on and so forth from like a personal finance standpoint that are like, hey, debt's bad. Mm-hmm. You know, don't like debt's terrible. Don't do debt. And it kind of creates this stigma behind leverage and debt and so on and so forth. But I think, you know, the rich people, they get rich because they invest in assets and they use debt to buy assets that produces free cash flow. And that free cash flow can be put into other, you know, investments and use debt in a good way. Bad debt is when you go swipe your credit card to go buy that Louis Vuitton, you know, purse or whatever it is that you don't have money for. And next thing you know, you racked up 50 grand of debt going on vacation and buying a bunch of crap that doesn't produce any type of cash flow. So what are your thoughts on that for people who are listening and they may have that stigma or they may not have that understanding of, okay, you know, you could use debt and leverage to invest in assets that produce cash flow and not all debt is bad? Or do you think, no, Steve, you know, you should be careful on leverage and debt is debt. And what are your overall thoughts on that type of strategy and philosophy?
Yeah, no, you summed it up very well. I think at a high level, debt is a tool of the ultra wealthy. Because you think about if you're using the debt to purchase assets that are appreciating, it's a beautiful thing, right? And especially right now, as we have very high inflation, and I think we're going to have inflation, higher inflation for longer than we probably would like. That's actually a benefit to real estate and other inflation protected assets and things that can track inflation. If you have fixed rate debt, right, the purchasing power, you know, of that, if your dollar decreases over time, so what you're paying back on the debt actually is less over time. Meanwhile, you can grow your income to track inflation. So debt is a proven tool of the ultra wealthy to leverage to buy assets and assets that will appreciate. And to your point, you can produce really nice cash flow, right? If you go buy a single family rental or something with all cash, your cash flow is going to be abysmal because if you don't have any debt on it, you know, it's not going to produce that much cash flow. Now, hey, your risk is very, very minimal. The bank's not going to call you up and take it back. But, you know, I think there's this kind of fine line of threading the needle of what's a good amount of leverage and what's too much leverage, right? So I think that's the bigger question. If you're still struggling with good debt versus bad debt, you know, there's a lot of good books out there. Rich Dad Poor Dad is probably the most common one that's, you know, I think makes a good case for that. But if it's more a question of what's good debt versus bad debt, I do think there is a lot of nuance there that investors need to pay attention to, because like what I see and what we talked about in our podcast for the past several years, a lot of these operators that are newer syndicators have no track record. They see the celebrity, you know, entrepreneurs getting into real estate and they can do it too. All these coaching programs. Well, they can go and buy, you know, multifamily properties with bridge debt. And this is non-bank lenders. They charge a very high interest rate. They have floating rates, you know, wink, wink. We saw what happened now. And they would go 80% at purchase and they would fund 100% of renovation. So this would be an 85% plus leveraged piece of real estate. That's a very heavy value add strategy, meaning it's not cash flow positive when you're buying it and you have a 2-year runway to try and get to cash flow positive. So you're taking a ton of risk. You have very high leverage and you had floating rate debt. So a lot of these, deals that were done over the past several years, I think we're going to have a day of reckoning because they're not going to meet their debt service coverage requirements.
Yeah.
They're not achieving the business plans they wanted. So I think there's an important element to understand what's too much debt, what's good debt, you know, fixed rate versus floating, you know, LTVs that are a little bit lower. You know, I think the type of lender matters sometimes too. So again, not to get too nuanced, but absolutely debt is used by the ultra wealthy. And if you think about it too, from a tax standpoint, the ultra wealthy are not paying a lot of taxes. Well, how are they doing that? One, they probably have a lot of losses that they're carrying forward either through real estate or other investments. And then the other piece is they're just leveraging their assets. So they're taking out a line of credit against their stock portfolio, or they're taking out a line of credit against some of the real estate that they have. And they're, you know, using that to not have a taxable event, right? And so if you have a big unrealized capital gain, you don't really want to go sell the asset to generate liquidity, right? Go use debt to do that, protect the asset, continue to defer. So you can actually make a good strategic move with that deferred, you know, tax liability and not be stuck with a big tax liability that you don't need.
Yeah. Spot on. Very smart. Okay. Last question. And then we'll wrap. So timing to all this. I mean, right now you see in the headlines, $1.4 trillion in commercial debt that's coming due. You know, you talked about like, you know, these properties, you know, LTV, you know, is going wonky and, you know, net income and operating income of these properties is dropping. And, you know, you're seeing issues in the commercial real estate space. There's also residential, you know, real estate where, you know, I was just looking, you know, at some report and it's like, usually the home sales are consist of, you know, 10 to 15% of them are new construction. Now it's like 35% because nobody wants to, you know, sell their home and swap their 2.75% or 3% mortgage for, you know, a 6% mortgage. So there's like a lot of interesting things happening in the real estate market with interest rates and valuations and commercial real estate and looming debt and all this stuff. Is there a good time? Like, obviously there's a good time and bad time, right, Ben? Like, obviously we're not idiots where it's like, there's sometimes where you want to hold tight, but overall with appreciation and inflation, eroding debt, and all this stuff, is there a good time and a bad time to hop into real estate? And what's your thought on timing? Or is it more just a long-term play? And if you're in it long enough, you know, investing in 2023 versus March of 2024, it's not going to make a significant difference.
Yeah, I can't believe he's opened up that can at the tail end of the podcast here because I have so many thoughts, but no. I'll try to keep it really short. I think first and foremost, the real estate market doesn't actually exist, right? The real estate market is actually a conglomeration of hundreds of individual markets, multiple asset classes, commercial real estate versus single family. So I think people try to conflate the real estate into a single thing. And there's some things that are performing a lot worse than others. And so you have to kind of get a little more nuance when you're talking about real estate. And I think there's definitely some headwinds, as we talked about before, because, you know, private equity, real estate, these aren't publicly traded and maybe mark to market. they are a lagging, you know, valuations lag the public markets. So I do think there is going to be some downward pressure on pricing. You know, cap rate is kind of the metric that most people look at when looking at valuations of real estate, and it inversely correlated with the valuation. So the higher interest rates, as it increases cost of debt, it naturally puts an upward pressure on cap rates, which puts a downward pressure on pricing. So we are seeing that. But to your point earlier, what's really unique about today and the market we're in right now is there's a ton of cash on the sidelines waiting for the right deal, right? And so, sure, I think we're going to have some turbulence. We've already seen some big blowups in some of these deals that are being foreclosed on and multifamily assets. But I think it's going to be more idiosyncratic and market specific, operator specific, that were done, you know, bad deals that have maturing debt, that have floating rate debt, that they can't meet they're too aggressive in their assumptions. But I don't think we're going to have a 2008 again. I don't think it's going to be this massive correction that takes a long time to come out from. And, you know, part of that depends on the credit cycle. How long does credit stay tight? How long do interest rates stay high? The longer they do, the, I think the probabilities of that go higher. But I think we're still early stages in this kind of reset, right? And so there's a lot of things to kind of unfold. But I think if you look at a fundamental supply and demand standpoint, you know, housing is an example. We have a massive shortage of housing, of both rental and single family homes.
Yeah, there's like a million in the US, I just read.
Yeah, it's estimated between 1 to 4 million. I mean, it's a big number. And we actually at the US still have slight positive population growth, right? So, you know, aside from all the millennials that are waiting to move out of mom and dad's house, that are going to continue to have household formation, which drives you know, demand for housing. You also have to continue to have population growth. So we need to keep building. But what's happening right now is the credit cycle is tightening. We're seeing a lot of new starts, new construction starts fall off a cliff, as you kind of expect, right? Because it's harder to get deals done. Banks don't want to lend. Well, it's only going to exacerbate the problem down the road. And so we're going to have housing shortages. I actually don't think residential single family homes are going to have that much of a dip. In certain markets, absolutely. You know, coastal, Sunbelt markets are probably going to have a bigger, you know, reset than, you know, Midwest. But I think it's going to be short-lived, and there's so much demand. I think it's, you know, it wouldn't be a very long reset, if at all. I mean, if you look at the cap rate forecasts, you know, it's anyone's guess what happens in the next, say 2 years. But if you have a 3 to 5 year to 10 year time horizon, the predictions are actually cap rates continue to go down, or they're at from, like, you know, a year ago, which means the prices are still going to go up relative to the cash flow that you're generating. So I think because of that, you have to have a business plan that can, I think when we're doing deals, we're still doing real estate deals, right? It's harder to make them work. It's harder to find the right deals, but we're shifting strategies and we're finding good deals. And it's having a longer term time horizon, having multiple exit strategies along the way. So you have optionality and you can play as the market, you know, develops and unfolds. But I think, you know, the simple answer is you have to be a lot more cautious than the deals you're doing right now. But inflation is not your friend as an investor. If you're just sitting on cash, you know, the purchasing power is decreasing. And in the right opportunities, I think there's still a really good opportunity to be had. And if you can think beyond, you know, the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, I agree. There's opportunities, you know, in pockets all over the place. And I love that. And I love ending on that. So thank you so much, Ben, for being on the podcast and just what you're doing. You know, you're adding a lot of value out there in a lot of people's lives. You're opening up the space for alternative investments through Aspen Funds. And for everybody listening, what I'm going to do is I'll create a page for Ben. So you can find Ben Frazier. He's going to be on the Boosting Your Financial IQ website. So if you go to byfiq.com, go under guest, I'll have a page with his bio, with links to where you can find him and connect and get more information on what he's doing out there. So be sure to check that out. And for everybody, thanks for tuning in for another great episode. I really enjoy this. And Ben, yeah, thanks, man, for being on the show.
This was awesome, man. It was really fun. Really fun. Thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers, everyone. Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. If there's any way I can be helpful to you and your business, or if you have feedback or ideas regarding this podcast, shoot me an email at contact@cultivar.com. I would love to connect. All the best.